in Ezekiel 36, verse 35, "And they shall say that this land was desolate, has become like the Garden of Eden, and the waste and desolate ruined cities become fenced and are inhabited." Now, I'm not going to go through all the surrounding verses around there, but I do want to call attention to this concept that there was a land that was waste and desolate, and then it became fenced and inhabited. There was some order that was set to it. So the land that was desolate became like the Garden of Eden. It was some put in order. We can turn to Genesis 1:1, and we can read what happened at the beginning of the Bible. Most of us have read that verse often enough that we know that in the beginning God created the heaven and earth. And then verse 2, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And that's in the King James. If you look at New International, verse 2, it says, "Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep." In other translations, it will say it was in chaos or in confusion. In other words, you might say it was desolate. And then came the creation. And in the creation, God, in those days, created the heavens or recreated the heavens and earth and formed the Garden of Eden. And notice in Ezekiel, we just read, it became fenced and are inhabited. But God put order into chaos. He put order into what was in confusion. Today, I want to talk about fences. Fences. That's what the verse refers to in Ezekiel. And I want to go a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the history of fences and then the spiritual value of fences. And show those analogies and what we can do in our spiritual lives. Many years ago, I would say about 1,000 years ago, the English passed what was called the English Enclosure Law. They used, at that time, lands were in common. People didn't particularly, they owned a land or an area, the lords or whoever the landowners were, but they didn't have the kind of fences that we see today. They had landmarks. They knew that from this hill or from that tree or from that rock and so forth. But when the livestock were commingled, they didn't have a lot of livestock breeds that developed. And yet, under the English Enclosure Law English did, people's private property rights were clarified. They said, if you want to protect your property, you were required to put a hedge around it, put a fence around it. And in so doing, you would keep your livestock in your field and the neighbor's livestock out of your field. And from that time forward, modern livestock breeds were developed. That mindset carried forward then as America was developed, and it's in the 16 and the 1700s and on into the 1800s, with the Wild West, the conquering of the American frontier. But it was an unfenced land. The wagon trains that carried settlers to Oregon and California traveled across the Great Plains in America. There were about 60 million buffalo that roamed the prairie, and we all know the Home on the Range song. And wild horses roamed that had escaped the Spanish conquistadores and were roaming in the West, and they still do, in unfenced and wild areas. But those were unfenced areas. In that time, it was unfenced, and so it was prairie. And wildfires would come up, and people were afraid of wildfires because they would go unchecked. It was fuel everywhere. And, of course, the whole state of Oklahoma and a good chunk of Arkansas today is a fire hazard. We saw that in Oklahoma a few years ago when we drove into a fire. Drove along the freeway, and all of a sudden it was at night following Thanksgiving week, visiting relatives on the other side of Oklahoma. And we came over a hill, and woof, we were engulfed. There was flames on both sides of the freeway, right on I-40. There was flames in the median between the lanes, and I didn't know we were going to get out of that one. And it was very spotty right then. Winds were up to 60 miles an hour. So this kind of thing occurred before the settling of the western frontier. And so the wildfires then would rage in the direction coming from the prevailing winds, usually from west to east. because that's the way the jet stream would go. And so in this day, you can see, particularly in the northern plains, you can see where the western winds brought the prairie fires to the lakes of Minnesota. And I grew up in southern Minnesota, and there were many, many lakes. And you would take a look at the lakes, and there would be no trees on the west side of the lakes. It would just be grass up to the lakes. And on the east side of the lakes, there would be large old trees that would maybe be 150 years old, or as old, you know, old oak trees and ash trees and elm trees. It would be very old. And my father explained to me, because I noticed this as a child, why are there no trees on this side, but there's plenty on. And he said, because of the prairie fires would come along and they wouldn't stop until they got to the lake. And then they may burn around it, but it didn't burn the. So the trees grew up on the east side of the lakes. And so those now, of course, in the last 150 years, since farms and ranchers have been putting fences up and intensely managing the land, we haven't had the same kind of prairie fires that have swept the entire prairie. During that time of the when it wasn't fenced, there were flash floods that went over the grass prairie, and then over the years it was severe soil erosion. There would be a lot of burnt areas, of rain would come, and then the soil would erode and through the Mississippi and Missouri River basin, and that formed the state of Louisiana, basically, is with all the silt coming down the Ohio River, Missouri River, the Arkansas River, and into the Great Mississippi and out into the Gulf. But with the coming of the settlement, particularly following 1849 Gold Rush, there were trains and telegraphs lines that went across the West. Farmers and ranchers could homestead 160 acres per person. But there was a condition. They had to improve the land. I have an uncle who is an attorney for the Farmers Home Administration. He's now retired. And he would tell me about the old titles, because he dealt with a lot of titles of property in the West. He's from Nebraska. And he, as a title examiner, he would examine the titles. And the original homestead titles, the law said that you could get your 160 acres if you built an 8x16 cabin on that 160 acres. And well, a man with a large family of about 8 kids, and many of them had large families, what they would do is the law was not clear 8x16 what. And so they built cabins that were 8 inches by 16 inches. And they would put them on the corner of 160 acres so that that 8x16 cabin, inch cabin, was on the corner of 160 acres in all four directions. And so by putting down one little cabin had to be, you know, would be on the on all top of all four 160 acre parcels, which would then mean one section of land for each child. But of course the law said you had to be over 21. Well, the land assayer had to document that the person was over 21 for that. And so what they would do is they wrote the number 21 on the bottom of the shoe of each child. And so when they went to the land surveyor and assayer's office, assessor's office, they would demonstrate they in fact had an 8x16 cabin located, you know, in those various places, and that they, each of the persons doing the homesteading was over 21. So that way one family could wind up with thousands of acres. So you found that to be a very convenient way. And of course then they would defend their property boundaries by putting up first landmarks of some sort, trees and stone piles and markers, and eventually fences. So the property was then partitioned over line, and it was no longer, you might say, it was no longer desolate. Now we drive across the great western plains of America, and any of us have done that, and we see miles and miles of fences which designate whose property is, you know, separates which one from another. I was growing up as a boy, and of course my great-grandfather was a pioneer, and so it was settled by the time I was a lad. And my dad told about a neighbor who lived about 3 miles away, Ed Schaefer. And I asked, how come old Ed Schaefer, you know, what was wrong with old Ed Schaefer? And my dad says, well, he was building a fence. And his hired man, and what they would do is they would sharpen fence posts. And the soil was black, and it was rich, and the topsoil was deep. And so they would sharpen the posts, and they would pound them in. Rather than drill a fence post hole, they would just sharpen them like a pencil sharpener. They would sharpen the post with a hatchet. And then one guy would hold the post, and the other guy would take a sledgehammer, and they would pound them in, and then go a few feet over, pound in the next one. And you saw many fences put in that way. And he explained that Ed Schaefer would hold the post, and the hired man would pound the post in with the sledgehammer. And when the post was pounded in sufficiently, old Ed put his hand on top of the post and says, "Well, that's good," but the hired man was still swinging the sledgehammer. And that's why old Ed had a withered hand. Because there wasn't the medical attention that you could have back in the 1930s that has come about since then. But everybody fenced their property. It was understood and expected. Well, now let's take a look. That was some of the history of fences and how it designates the difference between one piece of property and another, how it keeps some things in and keeps other things out. Now I want to cover a little look at some spiritual value of fences. Some of you know that I have sheep. I have a few sheep. I have 10. Sheep are basically a stupid animal. Perhaps that's why God refers to us sometimes as his sheep. See, sheep don't readily defend themselves. They're vulnerable to predators. They bleat. They make a lot of noise when they want something. And this announces to the predators in the whole world where they are. So sheep need protection. Now, our pasture at home is fenced with woven wire. It's about 4.5 feet high. The sheep can't get out, and the predators can't get in. And once in a while, there's a dog or pack of dogs loose in the area. But they're discouraged from attacking the sheep because the sheep are protected by the woven wire fence. Well, the fence also protects the sheep by keeping them from wandering around the neighborhood where the dogs, or in our case as well, the coyotes, could ravage and destroy them. So my sheep, the kind that I have, are actually a wild sheep. They're black-bellied Barbados sheep, originally from North Africa and the Caribbean. And it's a threatened species, which means there's about 1,000 of them in America. The rams have curly horns. They look like they're brown in color. They don't have wool. They just shed hair in the summertime. They're naturally a wild animal. They're like the Rocky Mountain sheep in that sense, but they're smaller. And so if they ever get out of the fence, if I can't lure them in, I would almost have to hunt them in order to keep them from running away or running onto the highway. Well, when I first got my sheep, I put them in a barn, penned them up in the barn for a few days just to get them used to the area. I had 3 of them. And I found out that they could jump. I didn't know this when I first got them. Sheep are sheep, and there's always the story about going to sleep and you want to count sheep, and you think of the storybook of jumping over the fence. And I didn't really realize how high they could jump. Well, I put them into our shed, and I put a 4x8 sheet of plywood across. It was a wide door opening. And with only a few feet of running start, the pen was about 12 by 12 feet, I was in shock as one of the sheep just took a running leap from about 8 feet and cleared a 4-foot piece of plywood and jumped out. And it wasn't planning on staying in, and it had escaped the pen. But it was all alone. It was still in the pasture, so it was safe from predators. But after several hours of running around, it was frustrated, and sheep have a herd instinct, or flock instinct, I should say. This errant sheep was very nervous about being alone, so it may take a running leap and leap back into the pen. And that taught me that that I needed to make a little higher gate. So the fence served some important purpose. It kept out the bad, and it holds in the good. Well, God has set boundaries for acceptable human behavior, fences that are for our own protection. Just as sheep, we're protected by God's law, and by living within God's law, we're safe. Let's turn to James in chapter 4 and verse 7. In James in chapter 4 and verse 7. "Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you." And if we keep going to the next verse, draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. So submit yourselves to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. By living within God's laws, we're resisting the predator, the devil, who is pictured in this scripture as a lion. That lions, of course, would like to eat sheep. Perhaps you recall some years ago, some of you may have heard, where a minister in South Africa gave the sermon about lions. In 1 Peter 5:8, we read, in 1 Peter 5:8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. So there are boundaries that we can use to protect us from being attacked by a predator. If we take a look in the book of Job, we can look at Job 1 in verse 6. Now, Job knew that there was safety within the boundaries defined by God. If we look in Job 1 in verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Verse 7, and the Lord said to Satan, From whence do you come? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. In verse 8, and the Lord said to Satan, have you not considered my servant Job, that there's none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil? Verse 9, and Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Verse 10, have you not made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? You have blessed the works of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. You see, Satan knew that he could not hurt Job because there was a hedge or a fence around Job. God protected and blessed Job. So God has his law, his expectations of us, to protect us by putting a fence around us, to protect Satan from us. As Satan acknowledges, he couldn't do anything to Job because Job was protected by the hedge that God put around him. Well, now that we've defined where God wants us to be, within the fences that he set up, within the boundaries that he set, what's required of us while we're inside the pasture, while we're inside the fence? Do we strung harps, pick daisies in the pasture? Do we skip and frolic in the morning sun? Or, of course, doing those things that aren't wrong, but just what is it that God wants us to do in our daily lives? Well, God has shown us in the Bible through his word in Micah 6:8 what he expects us to do. In Micah 6:8, he has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? And he puts down three things here: to do justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. And he forms it, just like in Jeopardy, he puts it in the form of a question. You know, what is it that God requires us, what does the Lord require, you know, to do? But to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. So, to do justly. You know, a number of years ago, I had the opportunity to watch, and as a I've helped many distressed people over the years, and I was in at a courtroom situation as I work with distressed fathers, and I was in a courtroom situation where the official court reporter, and the judge had a court reporter, and the official court reporter was recording all of the comments that were made in court. And the fellow in court showed me how then after the court, that what the court reporter wrote down wasn't exactly the way it was said in court. And there were several of us going, you know what, that's right, that wasn't that way. You know, that's not right. You know, that the official record was something different. And the court reporter, as it turns out, was conveniently altering the record so the judge would have a way to base his decision on it. And so one of the fellows suggested, well, you can solve that problem. And everybody wondered, well, how are you going to do that? And he said, hire your own court reporter to sit in the courtroom and type out a transcript. Now you have something to work with. And it was amazing to watch, as I got to watch that event and as I watched it play out, where a second private court reporter came into the courtroom, and it was amazing that the regular court reporter was extremely upset. The judge was extremely angry that anyone would question them, but it was a public trial, and you couldn't stop them, a second person, from taking the super accurate notes of that. So we know that doing justly appears to be a bit of a challenge. If you can take a look in Luke 18 and verse 2, in Luke 18 and verse 2, it was just a simple verse, and it goes on to tell the story about about the importunate widow, and I'm not going to go through all of that. But I want to call attention to just part of that verse in Luke 18:2. There was in the city a judge which feared not God, neither regarded man. When I did the research for this particular message, it was some time back, the New Hampshire Supreme Court, a number of the justices were caught in a lie. In fact, in multiple lies. And they were, several of them were resigned and several of them impeached. And the governor had to appoint replacement judges. In the Virginia State Supreme Court, it was exposed that there was, surprise, surprise, a falsification of transcripts by the judge at the Supreme Court level in a state. So doing justly, it seems to be very difficult, even for those people whose job is to be just. I know there are bureaucratic excesses that have a very difficult time doing justly. It was a number of years ago, and I used to be a young man, and I bought a farm, and I dug a ditch on this farm, and I thought it would be wonderful if I could improve the outlet of this ditch. And it was remarkable that in order to dig a ditch, I needed, as it turned out, a total of 13 government permits to do this. It took me 5 months. It took me the help of the state legislators, the congressman, this U.S. senator. It took every state and federal agency, one would tell the other, from the Army Corps of Engineers to, and I thought, remarkably, you know, there ought to be a better way, and they each had their own rules. So, and I'm thinking, and by the end, I wound up with a briefcase full of permits, and one permit says you can dig the ditch, but you must put the soil on one side and then on the other side, alternating the sides of the ditch, so that if you have a predator, it can't run up and down the ditch bank, so it can't eat or can't, you know, disturb the duck nests or the geese nests or whatever's nesting, which sort of makes sense, you know. On the other hand, there was nothing, then there was no spoil bank there to begin with. Another one said, well, we're going to need you to, the waterfowl don't like to watch each other when they breed, so we're going to need you to make some private places. You've got this open ditch, and the wildlife are uncomfortable with that, so you really kind of need to dig separate duck ponds or something there. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't I just put in a couple of side channels, and then they can have their privacy. I'll respect the ducks and geese privacy, okay? And so that was a bit of a challenge, so we got to work through. By the time I was all done, the Army Corps of Engineers says, well, you can dig the ditch, but you can't put any of the land back on the ground again. And so I had a briefcase full of permits, and they all said something different. One said you could put the soil in the ground, alternating a pattern. Another one said you could had to haul it all out, and you dare not spill even a teaspoon, and then and so forth and so on. So you had, and I'm thinking back to this verse about doing justly. So which one was right? Which is very puzzling. I also note there's 2,000 pages of federal law to regulate the price of cabbage. Doing justly appears to be a real challenge in this world. It's a real challenge because if we take a look at the world dictators we have, what they did was just in their own mind, in their own eyes. Of course, if you ask Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin or Mao Zedong. You could have asked Robert Mugabe, who is the dictator in Zimbabwe, formerly known as Rhodesia. Perhaps we could ask Pol Pot what he thought was just, who was the author of The Killing Fields of murdering Cambodians, or the butcher of Baghdad. More recently, the Saddam Hussein. There was a fellow there who was so afraid that he lived in between the walls, built another extra wall in his house, and lived between the walls, much as Anne Frank did during World War II, lived between the walls for 20 years because he was afraid to even let his existence be known for fear that he would be killed. Some of you may have remembered Idi Amin, the butcher of Uganda, or more back into the earlier time, close to 1,000 years ago, Vlad the Impaler of Romania. And then, of course, all of those injustices over time. And then, of course, we bring it up to our own neighborhood, where I did a little research and found that the local police department enacts a highway tax of about $60,000 a month in traffic fines. And that's in my small town of 2,350-some people. So what is, you know, the definition of just? We have cheating that goes on in schools, not just in the schools themselves, and I'm thinking particularly high school, because my wife and I are attuned to that, but the tests that they take for college. If you've got a particularly good athlete, and you want him to go to college, it's not uncommon to send in somebody who looks vaguely like the athlete to take the college prep exam. And we could name names, but I won't here. I'm on tape. for when this does happen. And you find out. If you go to university, at the fraternities or sororities, they maintain research papers and old tests in almost every subject. So that if you want to see what's going on, you want to buy a test, and you can do it over the internet as well. Well, and then there's the newspaper scandals, the New York Times, and now CNN has or New York Times was caught by people who were putting in articles that were false, just false quotes, just made up, and didn't have. Now we find a CNN reporter was making things up and false attributions. And it's always easy to look at the other guy and saying, so-and-so didn't do justly. Well, how do we do justly in our own personal lives? Do we treat our neighbor kindly by returning the borrowed items or offering help when it's needed? Do we anticipate an opportunity to help others? How do we do justly? Do we live up to our word every time, which includes reading the documents before we sign them so we avoid the problems later on? Very common problem. Very difficult. Or being careful with our responsibilities. So doing justly is something that's very difficult for mankind to get a grip on. The second thing in Micah 6:8 is asked us to do is to love mercy. Now, I've mentioned some of the dictators before, but I do want to call out one in particular, Pol Pot of Cambodia. And you may have heard or read the book or heard of the movie The Killing Fields that was popular about 25 years ago or so, maybe 30. And it was in the mid-70s that Pol Pot was the dictator in Cambodia. And he documented carefully what we would call the intelligentsia, every doctor, any teacher, anybody who was educated, and he had them executed. Anybody who had any education, he executed them. And then he forcibly de-urbanized the nation. He drove everybody from the cities on a moment's notice, and made them go without packing, without food, without anything. And if they didn't keep up, they were killed. About 6 to 7 million people died in that debacle. We didn't see, and there was a complete absence of mercy in that. Now, that's an extreme. Now, if you're a parent, you have an understanding of mercy. Because if you've raised children, you know that every child that's ever been raised has wet its diaper. And after they're out of their diaper, every child ever raised has had an accident and wet their pants. And what good does it do to get overly excited or angry about something like that. So as a parent, our heart goes out to our own children because it's like, don't cry over spilled milk. It's something that's already done. And you exhibit mercy to those things. I bought a brand new pickup truck many years ago when my daughter was 2 years old. And she, delightful girl, just, you know, when they're 2 year olds, they play around with everything that they can find. She was about 2 years, 2 months old. And she was playing in the parking lot where I was at, and she picked up some little stones. I didn't know this, and she put them in her pocket. Stones are fun. Little rocks are fun when you're a child. And she put them in her pocket, and I, summertime, and so I needed to put her in a safe place for a moment. I was talking to somebody, and I didn't want to have to watch her. So I put her in the cab of the pickup truck. I rolled down the window. I'm right there. Unbeknownst to me, while I turn my back, little two-year-old, she can stand up, grabs a hold of the steering wheel, and grips it, and takes a little stone out of her pocket. And on the inside of the windshield, directly where you would have to view it, she scratched the windshield. So that on my new pickup, no matter what I did, you just couldn't avoid the scratches. She's 2 years old. It doesn't pay to get very excited about it, because she's not going to understand it anyway. I learned a lesson that don't put children with stones in anywhere where there's glass around. So mercy, if we're a parent, we understand. In Deuteronomy 32, verse 35, in the subject of mercy, what's our first thought when something goes wrong and it doesn't work the way we wanted it to? In Deuteronomy 32, verse 35, is our first reaction to have visceral revenge? Does it just well up inside of us? That's natural. And the reason, it's because it's so natural, God gives us instructions. He puts some limits on it. He puts some fences here and says, to me belongs vengeance and recompense. Now, all of that is another message for another time, but I just wanted to call attention that it's God's job to take care of those things. It's our job to understand and extend mercy, even if it's difficult. And I will admit that I'm human as the next person, and understanding how to extend mercy can be a challenge. The fellow who lived in Iraq, in between the walls of his house for 20 years, didn't expect mercy from a dictator who murdered his own sons-in-law because he was concerned that they weren't as faithful to his government. The dictators murdered his own sons-in-law, promised them everything would be fine if they would only come home. And so this man had a good reason for not expecting mercy. But God expects us to love mercy. And that means by showing mercy. The third thing in Micah 6:8 is we're to walk humbly with your God. Wants us to notice the personal pronoun in that expression, walk humbly with your God. The word your bespeaks a personal relationship with God. In other words, if we want to walk with somebody, it's like saying, walking with your friend. Whose friend is it? It's your friend. So you need to have, to be able to walk humbly with God, you need to have a personal relationship with God. And that means you need to invest with your friend or with your God, you need to invest time and communication with your God. So just in the first reading of that is the use of that personal pronoun indicates it's a personal relationship. And then to walk with someone, if we can take a look at Amos 3:3, reference to Amos 3:3, can two walk together except they be agreed? Now, have we seen two people who are sworn enemies walk hand in hand down the rose-petaled path? Not too likely. You're going to see animosity. You're going to see maybe, if anything at all, you're going to see an exchange of hostilities. If people aren't agreed, they are likely not to be walking together. And so the So then what is a humble walk as compared to, say, an arrogant walk? You know the expression, the cock of the walk, a rooster that will crow loudly in the morning, announcing that he's in charge of the world, or at least his world. And you know that the expression strut like a rooster, you know, some people are known to crow or strut like a rooster. I know that one of my best friends, I had a flock of little girls and he had four little boys. And we would spend time back and forth at each other's homes. And my daughter could not pronounce the name Reuben. But he was the youngest in the family. But he enjoyed expressing himself loudly, as often youngest do. So the closest she could come to Reuben was to call him Little Rooster. Wasn't that just how it stuck? It was for quite some time. He was not Little Reuben, he was Little Rooster. So, which we all thought it was funny. My wife used to live in Europe, and she can tell you that the American walk is different than the European walk, that you can identify how a person carries themselves by how they walk. I do want to call then, the sermonette had us turn to Ezekiel 11:20. I do want to turn to that because we're because our subject here is fences, in other words, the limits that God is setting and the value of those limits. So I'm going to turn. I didn't have it written in my notes earlier. So in Ezekiel 11:20, in verse 19, he was talking about the stony heart being replaced with a heart of flesh. In verse 20, that what is it that's done with that heart of flesh? That they may walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. This is what God has in mind for us, that we do what he wants us to do, to walk in his statutes, to keep his ordinances. We know that he's outlined the Ten Commandments for us. We know that that he's codified those commandments and then placed the expression of the fulfillment of those commandments about loving God is like one category, and loving our neighbors as ourselves is the other category of those commandments, as a descriptor as to how we are to carry those things out. And so that is critical. That's the whole purpose for God setting boundaries for us, setting the boundaries, setting up his law, setting up the commandments of God. And Mr. Jackson in the sermonette also turned to Hebrews 10:16. I'd like to turn there as well. In Hebrews 10:16. Because where do those boundaries belong? Where is it that the boundaries for God's expectations in our lives should be? In Hebrews 10 and verse 16. And this is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws into their hearts and into their minds. I will write them. And their sins and iniquities I will remember no more. Where does God's law, where will it be written? It's on people's hearts. It's in their minds. It's how we do what we are expected to do. If we look back then on Micah 6:8, we're to do justly, we're to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Now, of course, the difficulty is this is in application. It's one thing to say this. Now, how do we apply it? Well, if we're a teenager, that's the age when we're reaching for independence. We test the limits. That's normal. I've certainly tested my parents. I like to think not as much as the neighbor kids, but probably my parents may have another idea. I remember my dad saying at one time, he says, he was telling rather proudly, he said, I've raised four boys to adulthood, and never once did the deputy sheriff drive up my driveway inquiring about the boys. I didn't know that he was that proud of us, but I guess that was uncommon, that there was others in the neighborhood that didn't have that record. So teenagers like to test the limits. They're reaching for independence. I remember I came home late one night And I realized that my dad had a rule that if you come home late, however late you come home, that's how much earlier you get up the next morning to do chores. And that was an awkward thing. And, of course, as not much sleep was required that night, I asked him about it. And he said, well, when he was a teenager, he made the foolhardy mistake of coming home late. And he drove in those days on a gravel road, 45, 50 miles to an amusement park in the Twin Cities near Minneapolis. And they had a grand time. He and his big teenage friends, and they were 16 or 17, maybe even 18. And they, filled the car load up with them and went and had a grand time and made it home at 4 in the morning. Because they were having a good time and the amusement park was open late. And he found to his chagrin that Grandpa, who always got up at 5, was up waiting for him. With the light on, he knew this wasn't going to be good. And he said, Grandpa said, well, there's no sense to go to bed now. We may as well go out and do chores. So they just went out to milk the cows and did the chores. And he says, now we're going to go out to the garden and we're going to pick potato bugs. And he said, all day long in the hot sun, there was a coffee can with a little kerosene. They didn't have insecticides or anything, or pesticides. Pick the potato bug, drop it in the can. Pick the potato bug, drop it in the can. All day long. He says, I got the message that there was a limit and we shouldn't disobey the limit that was set for us. And it was for my benefit. And sometimes it was a little hard to learn the limits. And so he felt duty bound to pass that responsibility on to the next generation, that there are limits and it's for your benefit not to go over those. But teenagers are reaching for independence and testing the limits. And that's why you hear so many car accidents among teenagers. So many of them wrecked cars. And you may hear of this. And I'm not going to ask how many of you wrecked a car when you were a teenager for fear that some of you might tell me. But because they're not knowing exactly what those limits are. I remember one of my younger brothers came home and he had gone to town to do some errand in the family car. And he came home and several of us others were busy with pitchforks cleaning out calf pens. Doing is what farm boys do. And he came down wearing his nice clothes, explaining that he had gone off the road and clipped a telephone pole. And I remember he told my dad, he says, but the car's okay. And I'd never seen my dad take his cap off and throw it on the ground before and say, what do you mean the car's okay if you clipped off a telephone pole? We all imagined it was U-shaped, and people, bad situation. But he had fortunately had gone off on the inside of a curve, and the I-beam on one of the under the car had lined up exactly with the pole, hit it exactly at the bumper at the right part, and it happened to be a weak enough pole that it clipped it off as it was going forward, flipped the pole up in the air, the car continued to go forward under the pole, and then it was hanging there, and the car indeed was not damaged except it broke the tie rod for steering underneath. So I know teenagers, and then as they go into young adults, are testing limits. Young adults, if we take a look at the jail population or testing limits, and if we take a look at the predominant number of people in our jails are 18 to 24. It's the biggest population group that we have because they're testing societal limits, or maybe they've been testing it all along and they really meet up with them now. And they weren't subjected to those limits before. I'm reminded of the time on the farm where we grew up on a dairy farm and the cows were in a lot. And the cows were turned out every day for exercise. And there were barbed wire fences up. And the lot, after a while, became a dirt lot because they had eaten all the grass in it. But it was an exercise lot. It wasn't really a pasture. We could set them out to pasture. But outside the lot, the grass would grow. And my dad pointed out there was a cow one day, she would put her head through the fence because there's grass that was good on the other side. But that grass apparently wasn't quite good enough, because along all the fence posts there was a tuft of grass on the inside. She chose to bypass the tuft of grass on the inside of the pasture to reach through the barbed wire fence to eat the grass there. But once she had her head through the fence, she got to looking around the post and saw that tuft of grass back in the lot where she was in, kind of wrapped her neck around, and she's eating grass back in the dirt lot again. That's a little advice that Dad gave me. He said, yeah, you want to be satisfied with where you're at before you take chances to go where you shouldn't. As we reach middle age, from young adult to middle age, there are family challenges. And often then, as we grow into the sandwich generation, where we have the burdens and the pressures of supporting children and parents, and we learn the fences there, the limitations that God has given to us, as well as physical limitations, because we are trying to watch after our parents, watch after our children. And then as we become older folks, and as we learn to become grandparents or great-grandparents, in my case grandparents, as of tomorrow we have number 11 due, gulp, I can hardly believe it, and learning then when and how to be involved in our children's lives. And that's something that we grow into. There aren't books on these subjects that teach you how, other than the Bible that says learn, that we must learn limits and follow God's laws and learn limits. So the application is really the challenge for how to learn the limits that God has set before us. He's given us our Ten Commandments. We've, as a church, have produced the Ten Commandments booklet, the New Covenant, an array of information that calls attention to how the Bible explains what's to our benefit, where the good grass is, where the pastures are that we can eat from, where the opportunities are, how we can serve God, and where we can do it. I do want to take a closing look at explaining and understanding fences by taking a look at the 23rd Psalm and reading it with in mind, with the in context, that God provides for us, and He wants us to stay within the limits that He provides. And then within those limits, and to avoid going outside of those limits. In Psalm 23, starting in verse 1, in fact, it's a very commonly memorized psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness, for His name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for You are with me, and Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Well, that 23rd Psalm has a pastoral setting. A psalmist is recognizing that God places him where he should be, as a sheep within the pasture that God selects. You might say within the fence, or within the boundaries that God places for our protection and happiness. If we take a look at verse 6 in the Psalms, verse 6, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That sounds a lot like Micah 6:8, that the three main points of the message: to do justly, which is goodness, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Dwelling in the house of the Lord sounds a lot like walking humbly with your God. So if we take a look at Micah 6:8 and compare it then to Psalm 23:6, we get that same message. Just as Job was afforded a hedge or a fence around him, and as King David was sure of God's protection of him, so too can we claim our hedge, our fence, our boundaries to be set by God's laws. So too we can receive the protection from our enemies and blessings from within the pasture of God. And surely goodness and mercy shall follow us all the days of our lives, and we will dwell in the house of the Eternal forever.